Welcome to the Flourishing After Addiction podcast. I'm Carl Eric Fisher, an addiction psychiatrist and bioethicist at Columbia University and a person in recovery. In this podcast, I'm investigating the world of addiction and recovery, which I think opens a door to some of the most important and fascinating topics in psychiatry and philosophy, as well as ideas that have huge implications for flourishing in general. I'm doing deep dive interviews with people working toward flourishing after addiction, people like scientific researchers, artists and writers, spiritual teachers, and more. My goal is to learn from their experience and wisdom, seeking out the practical lessons focused on flourishing and positive change, while still respecting the depth and nuance of addiction and recovery. If this sounds interesting to you, head over to my website, where I have other resources and materials about addiction and recovery. If you sign up for my newsletter, you'll get a free guide I made about the many paths of recovery. I'll also send you updates about books, research papers, and other things I'm studying and exploring. The email list is the only way to get a few of these resources and newsletters, so please do sign up on my website to be in touch. You can find all of that at carlericfisher.com. So, not much housekeeping this episode. Just wanted to say it's good to be back in front of the mic. I'm doing interviews, have some new ones lined up, lots to review, lots of interesting works in press, including the book that spawned this episode, came to me as an advanced copy. It's great to be connected with people across different disciplines and speaking to different audiences. I will remind you that the paperback version of my book, The Urge, is out. If you don't have your copy yet, go ahead and grab one. Head over to my website, and I have all the links there. So for today's episode, it was my great pleasure to speak with a philosopher and writer, Clancy Martin. Clancy's a professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, as well as Ashoka University in New Delhi. He is a writer. In addition to several books on philosophy, he is the author of a novel, How to Sell, and many, many magazine articles that have appeared in The New Yorker, New York Magazine, The Atlantic, Harper's, and so forth. He's a Guggenheim Fellow and is the survivor of more than 10 suicide attempts, and is a recovering alcoholic. And so that, the suicidality and addiction, is the subject of his new book, out today, March 28th, How Not to Kill Yourself, A Portrait of the Suicidal Mind. I thought this was a really fascinating and valuable book. It discusses suicide, of course, but also extensive discussions about addiction. The book in particular talks about how suicidal thinking, on Clancy's view, is a lot like addictive thinking, how he felt he was addicted to suicidal thinking in the same way he was addicted to certain ideas about himself and his life, addicted to the desire to escape from pain, other topics like luxury, consumption, coercion, sex. As we discuss in the podcast, I don't necessarily agree with everything he says, but that's a benefit, if anything. He takes bold stances, provocative arguments about a variety of topics in mental health. It was stimulating and even, dare I say, fun and wry and witty in a lot of points. It was a great read. So please do go ahead and get yourself a copy of that as well. What I learned from writing my own book is that these early orders matter quite a bit. So if you are listening here in the early days of his release, please do check it out. So on this episode, we talk about a ton. We talk about suicide, of course, but then focus more on the addictive part. So the pervasiveness of addiction, how it is insidious and in some ways universal, Clancy's issues with a on-off or binary way of looking at addiction and its relationship instead to habit, his complex relationship accordingly to the term alcoholic, how he identifies as an alcoholic in recovery, but also has some thoughts and some ambivalences about that. Talk about relapse as a part of recovery, the role of Buddhism in his recovery. More broadly, the role of faith, taking a leap of faith in an existential sense, Clancy, as a philosopher, discussing existentialism and what he learned from existentialist philosophy in his recovery, the role of human factors and teachers, big sweeping ideas such as how to be free and happy, riffing off of talks by Bertrand Russell, practical ethics, in particular parenthood, and how his perspective on the roles he plays in his family and life have changed positively over time, as well as his perspective on ego and self-centeredness. And for the writers among us, we talk a little bit about writing and craft. So without further ado, I do hope you enjoy my conversation with Clancy Martin. All right, so I'm here with Clancy Martin. Clancy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I'll probably say more about this in the introduction, but I really enjoyed the book. Andrew Solomon called it unusually brave, which I agree with. I think the boldness and honesty and authenticity really comes through in a useful way. And for the readers and listeners who come to this pod, I think the way you link suicidal thinking with addiction and possibly universal elements of suffering is really fascinating. So I was hoping to start by jumping in there about how you understand addiction. You know, I often ask people how addiction has touched their lives, I think you were kind of skeptical of holding on to the notion of addiction or alcoholism too tightly. Is that true?
That's entirely true. I am. I think that we have a tendency to fail to recognize how pervasive addictive thinking is and how deeply it is structured into our ordinary thinking in all different ways in many, many different people's lives. We have a tendency to focus on those cases where the addiction becomes sort of socially flagrant in a particular way. So, of course, if someone dies by suicide, then, you know, we're like, oh, look, or if someone has a disastrous collapse because of their addiction to alcohol or heroin or some other substance, and it's, you know, one of these big burnouts that catches our attention and we say, okay, now there's addiction and there's the consequences of addiction. But for me, in my way of thinking about addiction, addiction is sort of both much more insidious and much more domestic than we normally take it to be. I think that we should recognize that addiction, when we say addiction, what we're really saying is habit. And our habits are everywhere. And some of them are very destructive. And some of them may not be destructive at all. Some of them might be, you know, as Aristotle and others after Aristotle have famously argued, necessary, extremely helpful, even constitutive of moral behavior. So I think that we need to recognize that when we're using a word like addiction, it's not a black and white on-off thing. It's the kind of thing that occurs on a spectrum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that part of the book. You talk a fair bit about the on-off binary conception. And you also say you identify as someone with alcoholism, you qualify it, and you're very clear that you don't put it at the center of your identity or think of it in that binary way. But that, so from the other side of it, why do you identify as a alcoholic?
You know, I identify as an alcoholic because I think it is the most honest label I can use, given who I am, my generation, the way that I was brought up and trained to think. You know, if when I was a kid, I was raised by two parents who were both in AA. I was raised by three parents, all three of whom were in AA, and my stepfather was my father's sponsor. when my mom left my dad, she left him for his sponsor in AA. So I was just raised thinking either you're an alcoholic or you're not an alcoholic. And according to that way of thinking, which I really want, I think is a very damaging, harmful way of thinking. But according to that way of thinking, I am definitely an alcoholic. So it's just kind of an easiest shorthand for me to say, yes, I'm an alcoholic. I'm someone who really, really ought to avoid alcohol. And if a friend of mine said to me, I'm a heroin addict, I wouldn't say to her, oh, that's an unhelpful way to describe yourself. I would say, I get it. You have to stay away from heroin. And sometimes you hear heroin singing a song to you at night and you're like, oh no, I don't want to listen to this heroin song anymore. And I understand that very, very well. I mean, I have many friends who self-identify as alcoholics, including my wonderful partner, Amy. She self-identifies as an alcoholic. And I would never have myself said, you know, like Amy can drink a few glasses of wine, does drink at least a few glasses of wine every month, even, you know, maybe as much depending upon the circumstances, as much as a glass or two of wine a week. But she nevertheless would say, oh yeah, I'm an alcoholic. And for her, that means I have to be very, very careful about my consumption of alcohol. But this is part of what I am trying to say about addiction more. This is an example of what I'm trying to say about addiction more generally, that if we get past the labels like alcoholic or heroin addict or the, you know, or suffering from alcohol use disorder or whatever label it is you want to apply, that's when we can start to make some progress on thinking about what we're really committing ourselves to when we talk about how we relate to this question of addiction. And once we are really thinking in a more intelligent way about this question, then we start to have better solutions than the kinds of solutions that we've had in the past. And also we have the opportunity to destigmatize in a way that we haven't destigmatized in the past. Because although I have an awful lot of good things to say about Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, as an organization, and Narcotics Anonymous as an organization, and many of my closest friends, you know, these organizations are absolutely core to their survival as human beings, that those organizations have in their way inadvertently contributed to the stigma against alcoholism and against addiction more generally.
Well, say more about that, because I feel an impulse to push back on that and maybe suggest that there's a lot of heterogeneity, and that also there are things that are affiliated with 12-step movements like national advocacy groups that are not necessarily part of AA. They might be closely related, but not actually part of the fellowship itself.
Right. Well, I completely agree with you that when it comes to the larger 12-step movement, in the larger 12-step movement, I think we are making terrific progress towards the destigmatization of addiction. I think that in the larger 12-step movement, and its many, many different, you know, expressions and formulations, the principle of anonymity is changing, and some of the kind of dogma that goes with a more old-fashioned big book way of thinking about AA or NA has really changed a lot and improved. And I also think that even in the past 10 years since I've been writing about this subject, both AA and NA have become much more open than they used to be, more open to the idea that psychiatric and psychopharmacological solutions or assistance to the problem of addiction can be helpful. There's, you know, I have been in many meetings where the idea that you were taking any kind of drug at all to help with your addiction was just considered to be, well, now you're on a dry drunk, or you're white knuckling it, or you're still addicted. You're just addicted to something different, you know. And my own dad, in one of his, you know, it wasn't a new observation, I don't think, but he used to say that a lot of his friends in AA, you know, he went to AA meetings every week until as long as he was free to do so. And he died in a psychiatric hospital for the indigent. But otherwise, he was at an AA meeting every week. But he would say of his friends in AA meetings, you know, a lot of the people there are just, they're still just as addicted as they were before. It's just now they're addicted to AA meetings rather than being addicted to alcohol. So it was a healthier addiction, of course, but it's still, in his mind, a form of addiction. And I also know what he was talking about when he made that observation. I mean, I myself used to be addicted, really addicted to meetings, you know. And as I think I mentioned in the book, I remember when I needed a meeting, and then I'd get in a meeting, and it was like taking a shot of vodka. I mean, it was just, suddenly I felt so much better, and all that fear and panic and need would dissipate once the meeting was going. But I think that until we recognize that even 12-step recovery programs are one way one good way of working on the problem of addiction and expanding kind of our thinking about addiction and expanding our thinking about how to help people and how to reduce the harm of addiction. And that there are many other ways. AA is one way and NA is one way. And until we kind of fully accept that, and maybe we have moved that way a lot in the kind of culture of thinking about addiction in this country and other countries, we inadvertently maintain, kind of reinforce the stigma, because AA and NA is the kind of membership in AA and NA is the kind of thing that almost by definition one tends to keep a secret.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and as long as we're keeping something secret, then we're keeping it taboo. And as long as we're keeping it taboo, we're going to keep the stigma in place.
Well, I can see your point. I still think it's a little heterogeneous, but I also don't. I think the AA is not even really the point. It's I think different models of recovery and different pathways people take are complicated. I'm interested in the path that you take and that you took. I wanted to talk about, you mentioned medications, you mentioned writing about addiction 10 years ago. I wanted to talk about the Drunks Club. So you wrote this article in 2011, and I remember it. And even when your book came across my desk, I recognized your name and your byline because I had held on to the article and even recommended it to people who were thinking through medications and struggling with their own relationship to addiction and recovery. I thought it was really useful. And, you know, for people who don't know it, or just for the listeners, I'll just say briefly that it's a long article in Harper's where you talk a lot about your history, your family history, and the way you use medications and coming out to your local group about using medications. They're just a really lovely job of working out what you thought about your own substance problems, is how I took it. But I noticed the end of the piece was really the cliffhanger. You know, there was a vignette about the temptation to relapse and encountering a gorgeous woman who is enticing you to drink. And so relapse is bound up with your own insecurities and your lust and your desire for acknowledgement and your need to be special, maybe just wanting to have sex when you're away from your wife. You know, it's a real harrowing tale. And even since 2011, I would wonder to myself, I wonder what Clancy Martin is up to. And so the answer from your book is that you had some rough times, that like you actually, after that article was published, you had the worst year of your life, right?
That's right. Yeah. After the article, the year after that article came out, I mean, I did make it out of that bar with all those temptations without making any regrettable decisions, but regrettable decisions were right around the corner. And I had no idea, you know, what was coming. And this again comes back to this kind of larger question of how we relate to addiction and how pervasive it is, and my resistance to kind of on-off thinking. Because part of the problem of thinking that you're an addict, if you're thinking of it in this kind of bivalent way, is that then you have this sort of opportunity to think, well, but now I'm kind of overcoming that. Now I'm on the other side of that, you know? And in my experience, that's not at all how it works. And I think it works, of course, differently for everybody. And I'm absolutely not recommending relapse. But I always understood relapse in one particular way before I went through my great experience of relapse, which, you know, my most important experience of it was in the year of 2011, that very year that article came out in January. The year that was to come was a heck of a year, an incredibly challenging year, and I attempted suicide several times that year. I had always thought of relapse, when the great phrase relapse is part of recovery, as kind of a, okay, if you've relapsed, don't give up, get back on the horse. That's, you know, I thought of that phrase as a kind of consolation prize, you know, like a way of encouraging people who have relapsed. And I remember when I was talking to a friend about this, and she said, it's so funny that you say that, because the way I always took that phrase, and this is a person who doesn't have any substance abuse problems, She said, I always thought that alcoholics and other people with addiction problems were just using it as a get out of jail free card. And I said, that is definitely not the way addicts think about relapse as part of recovery. They don't think of it as a get out of jail free card. But I guess I could understand someone who had never struggled with addiction thinking in that way, you know, like, oh, well, relapse is part of recovery. Why not relapse? I'll just start again tomorrow. No, that's not the way they think of it. But I also no longer think of it as a kind of consolation prize or as a kind of encouragement to someone who has relapsed, although it's good that it can fill that role. I think of it as a simple statement of truth. It's just the fact. Relapse is part of recovery. And as I say, I'm not recommending relapse. If you are someone, one of those people who quit, and then whatever your process of liberating yourself from the substance has been, you've just never gone back to that substance. Great. You know, don't, I say, is my vote. Don't ever go back to it. But for me, how it's worked is that, you know, there have been a series of relapses and of relapses of diminishing severity and of diminishing psychological destruction and of diminishing sort of weight in the way I see myself. So relapse as part of recovery for me has been coming to see more and more how alcohol doesn't, this particular addiction to alcohol doesn't define who I am at all, really. It's part of who I am, of course, in the same way that, you know, I am someone who has five children, and I'm someone who's married, and I'm a philosophy professor, and I like to write, and all these. Of course, it's part of who I am, but it doesn't define who I am in this, you know, very heavy way. And that's what I've learned from relapse as part of recovery. Like, oh yeah, well, and if I don't drink, but if I relapse again, it won't be the end of the world. You know, it's not like, oh, now I've had this terrible, I'll just continue with my recovery as I have in the past. You know, no big deal. Just keep on going. And I mention in the book this wonderful person I met in a meeting who I was talking about relapse as part of recovery. And she said, you know, Clancy, I've stopped counting how many days I'm sober, and I don't tell people how many days I've been sober, and I don't wonder about when my last relapse was. I don't care. It's irrelevant to me. I could have been, all I'm worried about is, oh, am I sober today? You know, that's all I'm, that's the only question for me. And I just thought, ah, now I am talking to someone who actually is showing me what liberation looks like, what freedom from that particular addiction actually looks like. You know, it's just not on her anymore. The claws of the tiger were off her back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Also, in the way you talk about this particular addiction, you're being very careful to specify that alcohol addiction is just one facet. And we started by talking about how addictive thinking is related to suicidality, is related to insecurity. You know, you wrote later in the book that you wrote, I'm addicted to Clancy. That is my addiction to a certain idea of myself and my life, parenthetically, and to hope to escape from the pain is the real source of my trouble. And so if you, I'm in addiction recovery. I identify as an alcoholic. I haven't relapsed on alcohol, but I've sure relapsed on insecurity or anger, or other kinds of harmful thoughts and behaviors. So, you know, by that definition, relapse is totally unavoidable.
Right. Yeah, that's right. If you think about it in a much broader way about what constitutes flourishing and freedom as just a human being, then it seems to me, again, speaking for myself, there are all these different things I'm addicted to. And the fundamental one is addicted to a certain kind of way of seeing myself and perhaps the importance of myself. And if I can slowly, with lots of relapses, let go of that addiction, then, I mean, which, you know, is ambitious, of course, and but I think is possible, then I think I can really start to experience some space, some room to move around, become better at being kind, at loving the people around me, at understanding the people around me, you know, because at realizing that it's not about me at all, you know, that it's about all of us. But as you say, I'm a terrible relapser when it comes to that question. And there are so many ways of relapsing when it comes to that question. This is something that I think the Buddha is so good on. You know, for a long time, I had trouble understanding why it was that pleasure was as dangerous, you know, from the Buddhist way of thinking about it, as pain. You know, I understood Schopenhauer's account, which is that, you know, pleasure is just that, pleasure is the negative state, that is, pain is constant, pleasure is just the absence of that particular pain. So I understood all of these various philosophers' accounts of it, but I didn't I couldn't really get it in a psychological way, because it made me feel like, you know, but happiness is good, right? You know, surely happiness is good. But the Buddha wants to distinguish between pleasure and that kind of jolt of pleasure and happiness, which is looks something more like freedom, ease, calm, you know. And I've been noticing more and more in the last few years how pleasure actually has more of a tendency to make me a kind of relapser in the way that you were describing than avoiding pain does. You know, it's like I get myself into a little bit more trouble when I have some good luck than I do when I'm having bad luck. And
let me ask about that, actually, because you mentioned Buddha and Buddhism, and I was struck that, you know, there's plenty of mentions of Buddhist philosophy throughout the book, which I'm naturally very inclined toward. But it's only in the appendix that you mentioned that you formally became a student with your teacher in 2012. And also, that's the first year after this awful time that we were just discussing, that worst year of 2011. And so I had to wonder how important Buddhism is to your recovery from addiction and from suicidal thinking. And, you know, it seems like the answer is a lot. It seems like it's really important to you, but you didn't really center that as part of the narrative. So this is both a substantive and a sort of style question about the book, I suppose. But like, it's not that you started off in chapter one saying, here, I'm a student of Buddhism and here's how I'm going to approach these philosophical questions. So was that, I mean, even just from the style angle, is that something that you struggled with or you were thinking about in the writing of the book? Or tell me more about that framing.
Yeah, for sure. First of all, to answer the personal question, yes, you're exactly right. It is 100% central to the recovery for me, especially to recovery from the sort of the problem of being Clancy, and definitely also the problem of my suicidality. If I've made any progress on this, and I don't want to jinx myself, and I don't know, you know, it's not like my suicidal ideation has gone away. It hasn't. It probably never will. But if I've made any progress, and I think in the past few years, I have made some progress, I think that has been thanks to my study and to the best of my ability, my application of the principles of Buddhist philosophy. So that's the personal thing. Now, you're quite right. Why not sort of lay my cards on the table right at the outset of the book and say, I'm a Buddhist, and, you know, this entire book is really informed by my attempts to live according to my understanding of Buddhist philosophy as it's taught to me. The reason that was a conscious decision, and the reason I didn't do that is that really two reasons. First of all, my hope is that I can help other people who are in my situation, regardless of their particular backgrounds. You know, that is, people who are struggling with suicidal ideation, maybe are repeat suicide attempters, maybe are being threatened by the notion of wanting to kill themselves as they open the book. And people have a whole host of different philosophical, cultural, and religious backgrounds. And I don't want someone to open the book while they're feeling suicidal and see, oh, this is about Buddhism, I'm just going to close the book again, you know, and not get help that might otherwise have been there for them. The other is that, you know, I've only been studying formal, I've only taken refuge, been a formal student of Buddhist philosophy for 11 years, not even 11 years yet. So I'm just not qualified to say, hey, this is going to be about Buddhism, you know. If I were qualified, I'd be very happy to be able to say, listen, here's how we ought to go into this. And but I'm not, you know. I have friends who are, but that I'm not. And even when I teach Buddhist philosophy in my philosophy of mind course, or this fall, I'm teaching a class on Buddhist philosophy, which is, you know, just straightforward Buddhist philosophy class. I start out by saying, look, I am not a qualified teacher of Buddhism in the way that a lot of you might be thinking about Buddhism. That is like Buddhist philosophy as a way of life. I am qualified just from spending a lot of time studying the texts to teach you, you know, how to read these texts in an informed way as a student of philosophy. But I'm not somebody who can say, well, now I'm going to introduce you to Buddhism. I'm not. Now, I always make a point, both when I'm teaching it in philosophy of mind, even if I make mention of it in a class I teach called Money, Medicine, and Morals, where we look at some social and behavioral health questions, I always make a point of making available to the students someone who is. So I have a friend who is a very, very, you know, he's a monk. He spent his entire life since he was 10 years old in Buddhist monasteries, and he's a fantastic teacher. Most of the teaching he does is down in Mexico, but he teaches all over the world, and he teaches meditation, and he teaches Buddhist practice. And, you know, his name is Tashi. And we get Lama Tashi on Zoom and say, you know, ask him any kinds of questions. Now you're talking to somebody who is qualified to teach you this stuff, but I am not qualified. So I felt that same way about the book, you know, that I had to kind of step carefully and not in any way suggest to anyone that I am here to teach you about Buddhism. I'm not. I can rely on the wisdom I find there. And I think it's really important that I do, because I think some of the best help that people will find, you can find in these great Buddhist philosophers of the past and from the Buddha himself. But I wouldn't want anyone to think, oh, that's what a Buddhist looks like, when pointed Clancy Martin, you know, because that I'm not that person. I'm happy to introduce people. Yeah,
fair enough.
I mean, I do know those people.
Yeah, even just from the standpoint of thinking about your audience or your ideal reader, that makes perfect sense. And I think the book works and its broader starting point. And so I asked this question not as a criticism of the book or how you framed it, but just out of curiosity to deepen on this theme. It does strike me that the Drunks Club, the article about your period of time in 2011, it's a lot about having difficulty with that third step that you invoke a few times of turning it over, finding refuge in AA. You're working through what you experience as the contradictions and the problems and the way that the AA program doesn't work for you. And then what you actually do take refuge in is Buddhism. And that is, I know from personal experience, because I've taken refuge in the Zen tradition, that's a serious program. Like, you take a bunch of vows, you know, it's taken as a pretty serious thing. So I personally was curious about, what was it about that allowed you to take that leap of faith to the Buddhist side and not the AA side?
Ah, that's what a wonderful question. But it helps that I think that you know what taking refuge is like. Yeah. Oh, I think this is the single best question, most helpful question that I've ever been asked. And I've never thought about that until this very moment. I'm so glad you asked me that question. And I'm just going to tell you the exact simple answer is that I happened to meet a particular teacher. And, you know, it's entirely possible, I think, and this happens to people. This is why it's such a, you have to be so careful when you, you know, of course, I've sponsored lots of people in AA. You have to be so careful as a sponsor to not put yourself in the role of a teacher, you know, and keep yourself in the role of a friend. But I think that the reason some people do sort of, in a kind of continuing the conversation as we've been having it, the way some people do kind of take refuge in AA, if you know what I mean, it probably has to do with writing, meeting at least sometimes a person. And of course, some people relate to Bill W. in this way also, I think. But for me, you know, I went on this, I had been interviewed by this wonderful person when How to Sell, my first novel, came out. And the reason the interview stayed with me was it seemed like she was the only person I spoke to of all the different people I spoke to when that book came out who understood my dad, the character of my father in the novel. And she really, really got him. And nobody else seemed to, he just kind of seemed like, for most people, kind of a stand-in stock funny character, which, you know, of course he is also a funny character. But, and he was a funny character. And my dad, he was a very funny guy. But she just got him. And when I found myself, and that stayed with me, and when I found myself single again in 2011, I remembered her in that interview, and I got back, I tracked her down on Facebook or something, and I got back in touch with her. And we started emailing back and forth, and then talking on the phone. And then we were like, we should meet in person. And she came out to Kansas City, and there was like this very powerful connection between us. And then she invited me on a trip. She said, you know, this summer, I'm going to do this thing I've always wanted to do, which is like this pilgrimage of famous Buddhist sites in India. And I thought, well, you know, I'm totally crazy about this person. She's completely fantastic. And also, I've always wanted to go to India because my dad, you know, used to go there very regularly. And so I thought, this is fantastic. I love to do this. But I had absolutely no intentions of becoming a Buddhist at this time. I, you know, and to be honest with you, I thought I knew a lot about, I really thought I was like pretty well informed on Buddhism. You know, I'd written about Buddhism in the context of, you know, in philosophical context, particularly for, you know, kind of like in the textbook side of things and all that. I'd always been the guy that my co-authors or co-editors would go to and say, you know a little bit about this Eastern religion stuff. Can you write the Buddhist part? And I'd be like, oh yeah, I know all about that stuff. I thought I did. And I really, really was ignorant. But anyway, so when we went on this and we visited all these sites and, you know, some very nice things happened along the way, but nothing where I was like, oh yeah, okay, I'm going to become a Buddhist. And then we were far north in the Himalayas in a place called Spiti, a valley called Spiti, where there's this little tiny monastery. And we were
Is this close to Dharamsala? Is this like part of like the Tibetan community in exile?
Yeah, it's part of the Tibetan community in exile. Yeah, it's some distance from Dharamsala, but it is part of the Tibetan community in exile. Yeah, it's quite close to where we were in Spiti is quite close to the Chinese border.
Gotcha.
And it's an incredibly desolate place as, you know, these, once you get up into the Himalayas above the tree line, I mean, it's just, you know, basically just rock and ice. So we're up there climbing up to the monastery, and then I hear this voice chanting in Tibetan is on a being broadcast on a speaker, and there was something. And then Amy, my partner, turned to me and said, that's Rinpoche's voice, Rinpoche being the shorthand for this particular person. Rinpoche is an honorific in Tibetan Buddhism, as you know, and I'm sure many listeners will know. This particular person who was speaking was Dzongtsar Jamyan Chense Rinpoche. And then we got to the temple, and we went into the temple, and Dzongtsar Jamyan Khyentse Rinpoche was there. I'll just refer to him as Rinpoche henceforth. Rinpoche was there giving teachings in Tibet. And there's a little group of Westerners, maybe 15 or 20, 25 of us were there. and uninvited. We were told it wasn't really for Westerners, that it was just for basically for Tibetans. And I watched this man teaching, you know, from daybreak until after, long after the sun had set, day after day after day, sitting up on that throne, just nonstop teaching. I mean, it was amazing to watch. I'd never seen anything like it. And at a certain point, he took us aside and spoke to us very sternly about about how we didn't belong there and this wasn't for us. And, you know, we were wasting our time and we were wasting other people's time by being there. And everybody left after I'd never seen such a depressed looking bunch of people. But anyway, we were all just totally disconsolate. We had gotten such a scolding, such a whipping. Anyway, then it was later on, about several weeks after, or some weeks after that, that we were down in Bir, which is much closer to Dharamsala, and where he has one of his teaching centers, and one of his homes is in Bir. And then that's when I wound up taking refuge with this particular teacher. But there was just I just had a kind of connection with this teacher, like I haven't experienced with any other teacher that I had ever had. And that was why I wound up taking refuge with. I've never met another, now sounding very religious, and it's not intended to, but I've never met another human being quite like this particular human being. I mean, it was a psychologically extraordinary event for me as a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's a very honest answer. You know, it's not an intellectual exercise to embark on a leap of faith or to find a place to actually find a true refuge, which makes me want to ask about philosophy in recovery, because I think it was Owen Flanagan who even designed a study or did a study about how well are philosophers even doing in general on measures like ethics and life satisfaction. And
yeah, I think it was Owen Flanagan. Yeah.
And the answer is not very well. But you seem to have gotten something from it. You know, like, if, for example, you talk about designing this class or wanting to design a class called How to Be Free and Happy. And this is during like the happiness craze. And speaking of, Owen has a book coming out soon called Against Happiness about this craze. And it's So you wanted to name this free and happy, presumably because there's something more than just the positive psychology. How do I feel good? Like, there's something missing that could be added from philosophy, perhaps. So I was just wondering, like, what then or now, just like, what is in that framework? What do you think people miss? Or what is the thing that you've gotten from philosophy in terms of coming up with a framework for your own recovery?
First, the title of that class is stolen from a lecture that Bertrand Russell gave to, I can't remember the particular group. There was a group either in New York or in Boston that he'd been invited to speak to when he was on his American tour. And he gave this lecture called How to Be Free and Happy. And it's widely available. And I recommend it to any listener. He's wonderful in that lecture. And he's speaking very candidly about his own life and his own experience of how to be free and happy. And you know, he seemed to have a lot of luck in that department, and he was definitely no positive psychologist. And I did, to be fair to Laurie Santos, who in my opinion is a brilliant teacher, I did use a lot of the resources that Laurie, which she very freely shared with me, I used a lot of the resources from her famous class at Yale in that. About half of the class, which I did wind up teaching, and people loved that class, about half of the class, a third to half of the class was coming out of Laurie's happiness class, and the other half was coming out of the philosophical tradition, particularly my own area of expertise, which is the existentialist tradition, you know, from Kierkegaard through, for me, from Kierkegaard through about Simone de Beauvoir's normally where I stop, which is more the freedom part than the happiness part, you know. And in the existentialist tradition, and what I think I've learned from the what I've learned from my own philosophical work in the past, say, 25 years or so, which is, I say, has mostly been on 19th and figures we would call 19th and 20th century existentialists, is that the central opportunity for and challenge for human beings is to make our lives meaningful. And the making of our lives meaningful is challenging because we are everywhere thwarted by dogmatisms, by structures of belief that are being imposed upon us very often for someone else's, according to someone else's agenda, but very often also just because of, you know, tradition, longstanding, you know, because of laziness, really, because of habit, you know, in a sense, because of cultural addictions. And so the challenge is, given this difficulty of other belief systems, constant of dogmatisms constantly imposing themselves upon us, how do we free ourselves? How do we make our lives meaningful? We have to be creative. You know, we have this inner creativity. We live these incredibly rich inner lives, incredibly dangerous, threatening, scary, but fertile and fundamentally creative inner lives that we have to be sort of brave enough to go into and look for the possibility of originality and be willing to trust in that possibility of originality, be willing to trust in that kind of fundamental human creativity that we all have, that all human beings share in common. And this is where, in the existentialist tradition, we have the opportunity to find a meaningful life, which is probably not going to be a life that is, you know, on the lower end of the suffering scale. Probably there's going to be a whole lot of suffering that comes along with this creative life that you are wanting to lead, that I am recommending even. It doesn't mean that, well, if it does mean that it's going to contribute to your happiness, it means so in a way that you're going to have to rethink your traditional concept of happiness a little bit and recognize that happiness and being in a state of pleasure are very different things. That actually being in a state of what you would normally describe as pleasure is not really what you want in the best human life. I mean, for me, because I'm a dad, one of the best metaphors for this is parenting. I mean, parenting is really hard. It's mostly, which is honestly, it's mostly suffering. There's a lot more suffering involved than there is, you know, the opposite of suffering. And, you know, you're going to be worried for the rest of your life. You're going to discover whole new realms of fear and anxiety that you didn't know before, and frustration and difficulty. And yet, there you recognize that this is more meaningful than any other activity that you do, and more important than any other activity that you do, and that no book that you write, no any contribution you may make to the world will not be as significant as what you are doing, as you are trying to, as best you can, without making too many mistakes, and we're all going to make a ton of them, to raise this child, this whole new universe that has appeared and has been entrusted at some level to you until they're off with their own universe entirely. And so, yeah, I think that's what I mean. And that's what I've learned from my own philosophical training about the freedom component of that, how to be free and happy. And when my friend Rita Kotari, who I mentioned in the book, who made fun of me over breakfast when I told her that I wanted to teach this class, How to Be Free and Happy. And Rita is the world's foremost translator of Dalit literature. Dalit is the class of people we used to be called untouchables in India. And she's done more for the writing of Dalits than anyone else in the world. She's an amazing person. When she made fun of me, she was right to make fun of me. And she helped me to see, yeah, you're right. I have to have a good humored, I have to have a somewhat ironical approach to this question of happiness, because I don't mean it in the sense that we might more commonly take someone to mean the word happiness, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's so much there. There's a lot I want to talk about there. I want to bookmark the parenthood discussion, because that's important in discussions of lineage and just your role within your family. I'll just mention briefly, I mean, people should just read the book. We're barely scratching the surface, but at the end, you have a list of several items that you have found to be helpful, and family and your role within your family and your stance toward your family is one. That was really moving to me as someone who is not too long ago a father. I have a 7-year-old. But first, I want to hover on the meaning and existentialist point you just made, because I'm sympathetic to it. I like existentialist philosophy. And what I understand you saying is there's an imperative for someone taking responsibility for making their own meaning and expressing their own creativity. And there's an accompanying imperative to be skeptical of dogma and all the rest. And I think a lot of people in both Buddhist practice and addiction recovery have the experience that there's too much of like the ego thrusting itself onto the world. It's too much of a self-centered focus on purpose, and whether you call it right-sizing or just taking your focus from the self out to the others, that's a remedy that not everyone, but a lot of people have found to be central. On a first glance, there's some contradictions there.
And there's some tension there, right?
Yeah, so yeah. The tension's probably a better word. So how do you resolve that tension?
Right. First thing I would say is it's not necessarily the case that we need to solve that tension. It might be the case that even as Buddhist practitioners, we need to learn to live with that tension and not sort of expect it to go away. And it might be that the importance of what we think of as individuality, and as opposed to sort of being free of individuality, that if we can embrace that tension rather than sort of trying to sort of escape it in some way, that is what will actually dissolve the tension, you know, if we stop, you know. In other words, what I'm saying, and then this is very much from a Buddhist perspective, is that probably part of the problem of why it's so difficult to eliminate the self, and why the Buddha lists this as the most difficult of the various tasks the Buddhist has to pursue, is the pursuit of eliminating the self. And you gotta let go of that idea that you're going to eliminate the self before you're going to make any progress towards that particular. Now, again, I'm not qualified to talk about this stuff, so I'm just kind of throwing that out there as a hypothesis that maybe living with the tension is a little bit more helpful. But you know, I don't know enough about.
No, I like that reframing. It's useful. I mean, it like a lot of paradoxical things and the philosophy of flourishing and in recovery and in psychiatry, then we have to live with two seemingly contradictory, but on a deeper level, actually compatible ideas. You know, George Valiant, the alcohol researcher, once famously said that addiction is both a particle and a wave. It's just like physics.
Yeah.
You know, it's both categorical and dimensional. And this comes from very quantitative studies on personality structure and the best longitudinal data that we ever had. And so I can get on board with the notion that we simultaneously have an urgent need to take responsibility for our lives and craft one of meaning and purpose, while simultaneously totally and completely letting go of any individualistic project of making ourselves into something special.
Yeah, you just said it much better than I ever could. Thank you. But that's exactly what I have in mind. And it is, I hadn't heard this before, although I know his work about both a particle and a wave. I think that's such a wonderful way of putting it. Nietzsche puts that's why I love this famous paradoxical formulation of Nietzsche's, how you become who you are. You know, it's obviously a paradox. You either are who you are, or you are becoming who you are not, but you can't become who you are. You know, it's a, but that this is, that it is inherently paradoxical once we get into these questions of selfhood. This is an idea that Kierkegaard and Nietzsche have in common. And somehow at the very center of what it is to be a self is a paradox for reason. It may not be a paradox for other ways of approaching the question, but for reason, it's a paradox. And that might be a really important qualification, because it could be that reason, you know, the conceptual proliferation that reason is so fond of doing, all this kind of, that might be a big part of the problem that we have to let go of. You know, we have to let go of the world a little bit. We have to let go of our selfishness a little bit. And maybe we also have to let go of our conceptual apparatus a little bit, all three of those things, in order to make some progress in living with this tension. Anyway.
Yeah. So let's come back to family then, because that's a great topic. We could be on it. But I also, this struck home for me, because you talk about, you could call it a practical ethics intervention you did on yourself, that you reframe your family life as, how can I find ways to be with them more and put them more at the center of my attention and care for them, rather than how can I keep them happy enough that they will let me do my work? And, you know, now a cynical reader, maybe an academic roughly 15 years younger than you who's currently interviewing you, might say, you know, I haven't written my dozen books yet. And I, you know, it's all well and good to say that once you pass the stage of life, but there's almost like an Ericksonian stage of life thing going on here, where maybe that's just the season you're in. Someone could read that and take it as a sort of recommendation or a prescription, like spend more time with your family because it is more important. That's probably true, but we also have work to do. So any thoughts? Any feedback?
First off, I agree that it might be, and I say this all the time, you know, that whenever I'm thinking about being a little less burdened with certain kinds of psychological pains or struggles, that at the end of the day, this might just be a consequence of just getting older. Nothing more complicated than that. You know, I'm getting a little bit older. So certain kinds of course, some things are going to get harder as you get older, and then certain other kinds of things are going to get easier, you know. So I'm very sympathetic to that Ericksonian interpretation, you know, fair enough. But also, I think that we need to, okay, for me, I made mistakes that I would have done well not to have made, on the basis of a kind of ambition that might have been much better satisfied in the end if I had reoriented myself earlier towards my family, and into, you know, in short, to say, okay, you know what? I'm just going to say my family comes first and my work comes second. And it's as simple as that. And the reason I say that is that I think I wound up spending an awful lot of energy on kind of the turbulence that I was creating by trying to find this balance between these two things, and and also always secretly in my own heart, I'm only speaking of myself right now, always also secretly in my own heart thinking kind of deep down, but my work, I've got to do my work. Why can't these people see that I've got to do my work, you know? And if I had let go of that idea, if I had tried to view myself more as a member of the community of my family, so I was like, you know, viewing their, you know, looking at myself a little bit through their eyes, more than always only feeling like I kind of had to protect my own territory, you know, and I had to, you know, nobody else was going to look at, because if it were up to them, they'd just have me doing this and then this and then that and then this and then that. And I'd never have time to do my own stuff, you know, because they got laundry lists of stuff they could keep me busy doing. If I could have just looked at it a little bit more through their eyes, I think that I would have saved myself a lot of energy, a lot of pain, a lot of struggle that wound up burning up time that otherwise could have been spent very fruitfully on the work that, after all, I thought was so important. You know, I think about it now, Carl, and I remember when I was writing my first novel and how jealously I felt like I had to protect that time. And you know, how I was like, okay, well, I simply can't be home before 5. And then, you know, a lot of times I would wind up not getting home until 5:30, and then there'd be all this turbulence and everything. And if I think about how I could have reoriented my days so that I could explain, you know, that these are chunks of time when I have to dedicate to this, but here's all these other chunks of time that I'm really wanting to dedicate to you guys, because you guys matter more than this silly novel I'm working on does. I think it would have, at the end of the day, actually been more effective. It would have been a better way of proceeding. And, you know, my partner Amy has a mentor who's at the University of Iowa, teacher at the University of Iowa, named Ethan Kanan. And Ethan Kanan, who's, you know, he teaches at the best writing program in the world and has all of his life and was a medical doc, got a medical degree from Harvard before he became a writer and then moved over to Iowa, the Iowa Writers Workshop. Ethan Kanan dedicates 2 hours a day, 7 days a week to his writing. Mm. And it's a hard rule. You know, these 2 hours are for me. You know, they're not for anybody else. They're not for email. They're not for my colleagues. They're not for my family. They're not for anybody. These 2 hours a day, 7 days a week. Everybody would have to come up with their own, you know, particular way of coming up with such a thing. But now, in retrospect, looking back, if I had done something as simple as that, I bet that book would have gotten written a lot faster than it did, to be perfectly honest with you. And I watch my partner, Amy, now, who's finishing her first novel and is a brilliant, brilliant writer, one of the best writers I've ever known. And, you know, half of this novel she's written with a baby asleep in her lap. And there's no question in her mind that her children are more important to her than her writing. But she has, you know, she manages to get a hell of a lot of writing done. And she happily recognizes that it's a collaboration rather than a competition. And for me, the great mistake that I made for so many years, and I hope I'm making it less now, I really hope so, is I just kind of like viewed it as a competition. I was sort of in competition with my family, you know? We had this finite resource, which was my time, and we were all going to compete for it. and it's just so much it's the way I've lived my life. You know, I felt like there's this finite resource called Clancy, and I've got to protect him. And then when the protecting this finite resource hasn't worked, I just despair, and then I try to kill myself because the hell with it. I can't. It's useless even trying to fight. I might as well just turn the switch and flip him off entirely. You know, I've got to let go of this idea that there's some sort of territory I have to protect. There's no territory. You know, It's all just all
right. Holding on too tightly to a notion of time. And that's one of the things I like about Zen. You know, Dogen talks a lot about time beings and that whole mind-bending approach to making us look at time. It also makes me think in your book about it's concert rather than a competition.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's concert rather than a competition. Exactly. It's concert rather than competition. And you're right. It reminds me of Dogen too. And I don't know if you like that famous little book I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing his name properly, although I'll be teaching it this fall, so I need to make sure I'm pronouncing it properly. But Shunryu Suzuki, is that how you say
right.
his name?
Yeah.
Shunryu Suzuki. And such an amazing little book, huh? And
yeah, fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, just fantastic. And I think it relates to this concept of that concert competition relates to this concept of, you know, small mind versus big mind, you know, and trying to have like a slightly, I'm never going to have a big mind, but maybe I can let my mind expand a little bit, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be quite so constricted as it is.
Yeah. Or obscured, maybe, who knows? I don't know what I'm not qualified to teach either, but.
Right. Obscured is a better word. You're right. Yeah.
Because I think the charitable take, I don't think I need to be a Buddhist teacher to say this, is that, you know, the big mind's there. It's just there. It was always there.
Yeah, right.
It's not that you won't have it. Yeah. It's just what's going to get in the way.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Clancy, listen, I have to ask you because, you know, you had this article in 2011 and you describe how you got some backlash for that and somebody came at you with a bat. And it upset your relationships with your support systems. And I have to wonder, and you know, 2011 was the worst year. Now you've got this book coming out. Do you worry about that? Like, do you think that publishing in other words, just how are you doing now? That's my wonder. I'm like wondering like what this is going to be like for you. How are you doing now? And how the publishing process is going to go for you?
Yeah. I'm a tiny bit worried about it myself. The past 3, 4, 5 months. I don't want to jinx myself, knock on wood, but they have been some of the least suicidal months of my life. I don't know why. And even the past year, again, knock on wood, much, much less suicidal than even my big last past bout of depression, which was about a year and a half ago. And it was a bad one. There was about a month, maybe 2 months that was almost could have gone to bat with my very worst bouts of depression ever. I mean, it was a really, really, really rough patch. And since then, things have been a lot easier when it comes to depression and suicidal thinking for me personally. And as I say, the past 3, 4 months, especially so. But I worry because, you know, like I was saying, sometimes the things that get you excited, the things that you think are giving you pleasure are the most dangerous things for me, the things that get me into the most trouble. And, you know, all the stuff that goes on around a book. And then also there already have been people getting angry and, you know, saying things. I've already received a couple sort of, well, the best way to describe them is kind of viciously unkind emails, and which I tried to, I have replied to all of them and have tried to reply to them in the spirit of understanding as best I can.
We should say, by the way, sorry to interrupt, but we should say that, you know, we're recording this about a week and a half before publication date. So this is, you know, if you're getting emails, these are people presumably who got a copy or someone you might know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, people kind of in the publishing world or world of writers and academics. And so, you know, I am a little bit nervous about it. And I am hoping that I will be able to just, you know, I have an incredibly kind, helpful, generous editor who's really good when, you know, something upsetting happens. And I have a wonderfully supporting family and who, you know, because my youngest child is 1 year old, she keeps me very busy. So does my 5-year-old son. And my teenage daughters are incredibly loving, kind, gentle people, and my eldest daughter, who's 28, and she too. So I'm hoping I can rely on these resources if things get rough. Right now, they really have been going so well, but I don't want to get too accustomed to that. You know, I want to be prepared that things might get there might be some really rough things that come up. And, you know, I'll rely on my family as much as I can, and I will try to remember that life is can be like being, you know, on a plane. I've been on a plane to India with a small child more than once, and you know, life can be a little bit like that. And we'll see how I do. But I, you know, and now I have a Now I have a new friend. If things are getting really, really rough, I'll send an email to Carl and say, Carl, man, I'm in trouble. You got any words of advice?
Well, I don't know if I'll have advice, but it is true. You've got a new friend.
Yeah.
Well, you got a new fan as well. It's a great book. You know, even like what we were discussing about in the finer points about addiction, I certainly don't agree with everything in it. But I think it's a really lovely essay, and it's an attempt, and it's a brave and bold and really thought-provoking and useful book that I think will help a lot of people. And I'm glad to get the chance to talk to you about it. The time has flown. I've got pages of notes. We could stay for another hour, but for our sake and for the reader's sake, let's maybe wrap it up. But you know, before we go, do you have the final words? Any, you know, maybe a request for the audience or final thoughts that you wanted to get to?
I do want to thank you thanks for your kind words and thanks for this opportunity. And I really enjoyed it. And I'm a big fan of your writing and will continue to be. And I think it's incredibly important for the whole question of addiction in our culture, your work. So thank you. And it's definitely an honor to talk to you about all this stuff. And I hope we continue to talk independent of the podcast. But I did want to say one thing, which is that we are going through a crisis right now. We used to call this a crisis of 15 to 24 year olds. Now it's a crisis of 10 to 24 year olds. Mm-hmm. Suicide is the second leading cause of death in this group. It may, if the trend continues, it may shortly become the number one cause of suicide in this, the cause of death in this group. And as a culture here in America, we're not doing a damn thing about it. You know, kids are sitting in emergency rooms for 48 hours and being sent home without even seeing a psychiatrist, without even talking to anybody who's qualified to help them deal with their suicidality, their suicidal attempt, their suicidal thinking, and not providing resources to their parents either. And so I just want to kind of tell the audience that insofar as you have the ability to help in any way, we have to, as a society, attend to this fact that we've got a mental health crisis going on among young people in this country, and it's expressing itself in terms of suicide attempts, skyrocketing suicide attempts, not to mention all the many other ways in which it's expressing itself. So I can't think of any more urgent call to action in our country when it comes to at least the questions of social and behavioral health than this crisis that we're having with young people right now. And, you know, part of it, no doubt, is COVID. It may have, there are a whole host of reasons, I'm sure, but we've got to start paying closer attention to it because these kids just really need our help.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's a crucial, crucial topic. You know, frankly, I didn't go into child and adolescent psychiatry because I hated dealing with the parents. You know,
yeah.
I don't think that this is an individualistic solution. It's not like we need to find the right technocratic intervention to perform upon the children. It's the kids are not all right because something is not all right. And what that something is, you know, we could have five more podcasts about social and systemic issues, but just to be attentive to and to care about that issue, I think is crucial, is really important.
Right. And even as parents, you know, I was talking to an editor not long ago about my book, and the editor told me that he was like, it had never occurred to him before. He has a child who's 6 or 7 years old, and they were watching Beetlejuice with their daughter, I think. And then he'd forgotten how the Winona Ryder character is suicidal. And talking about suicide a lot, and that, you know, part of the story of the movie Beetlejuice is about how she recognizes that suicide is a bad idea, that she really wants to commit suicide. And I guess he was looking at his wife, and they were asking, like, oh my God, we're watching this movie we love, Beetlejuice, with our child, and we didn't realize that there was all this talk about suicide. You know, they'd just forgotten the movie. And he said, and then it didn't occur to me until your book. I had no idea that children under the age of, you know, 10, 11, or 12 thought about suicide. And I said, yeah, well, don't feel bad, because the psychiatry business, you know, for generations thought that children were incapable of thinking about death or suicide before about, you know, almost pubescence. I mean, it's amazing how ignorant we've been on this. I think a lot of it has to do, honestly, with more and more women coming into the field and then just having paid closer attention to children than the men who dominated the field previously had, you know. But anyway, you know, I mean, I was thinking about suicide when in my very first memories, I was thinking about suicide. And we're afraid to talk to our kids about it because we're afraid we're planting a seed. But the literature on that is just crystal clear. You're not planting a seed. You're giving them the opportunity to talk about something they've already worried about or thought about or have questions about, you know, and they're going to be exposed to it. And one of the best medicines that we have is just simply talking. And we know it's proven that talking works. So even just being willing to have these conversations with our kids so that they know they can talk to us about this stuff, that alone would be a huge step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, so, you know, I can imagine the listener might be wondering, well, how do I talk and so forth and so on. And, you know, I'll just say it's great that in your book that is literary and playful and exploratory, it ends on a very practical, pragmatic note. A lot of good resources there in the appendices and otherwise. So once again, I do encourage everyone to pick up Clancy's book. And Clancy, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's great to meet you.
Really great to meet you, Carl. And thank you so much for having me. And
thanks again, Clancy. Thanks for all your work. Okay. And to be continued.
Yeah, thank you, Carl. Okay.
That's my interview with Clancy Martin. I hope you enjoyed. So I have a lot of stuff to link to in the show notes. Clancy's writing, also Bertrand Russell, Clancy's Buddhist teacher, Shunryu Suzuki, the writer Ethan Kanan, and more. I'm not sure that I even want to try to sum up our conversation, but if you want something like a taste of his arguments or some of his arguments about alcoholism, I would check out his cover story for Harper's back in 2011, The Drunks Club. And I'll link to that too. It was a personal account about the role of medications in his recovery, his ambivalence about recovery and abstinence, the difficulties he was facing at that time, and also a really lovely way I thought of using writing as a vehicle for being, again, on my reading, being humble and working on acceptance of his limitations. So again, check the show notes for links to those things. You can find more information over at carlericfisher.com. And bottom line, buy Clancy's book. It's out today. It's really fascinating. I think you'll find it interesting. While you're at it, buy my book. Links and more are up on my website, including my email list. If you sign up, you immediately get a free guide I made about the many paths of recovery. You'll stay up to date with the latest episodes, show notes, and other writings. And finally, one last plug. If you're finding this podcast useful, please help me get the word out. You can subscribe on your podcast player, leave a rating and review, and most personally, most fun, send the episode to just one other person you think would benefit. Thanks so much for listening. I'll talk to you again soon. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It isn't medical or clinical advice. The content is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have questions, please consult a medical professional. Conflicts of interest are an important topic in addiction and recovery. For now, this podcast is just me bringing these conversations to you, ad-free, for their own sake. I do have a list of disclosures about my work and positions on my website, which I will keep updated.